This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture with me, Juliet Jacobs, and with me today are Lim Soo Ann and Dashran Johan. So we've got a story for you today, and it's about a recent report released by UNICEF and the International Telecommunication Union, which highlighted that 2.2 billion school-aged children and youths worldwide don't have internet access at home. So in a time when education in many countries has been forced to go online, we're going to explore how dire the situation is here in Malaysia and the possible consequences of the on the younger generation.
Yes, that's right. And on that note, we do have a poll over on our Twitter page at BFM Radio. And we want to know, like as Juliet mentioned earlier, education has been forced to go online. So we want to know how either you or your kids, how their online classes have been. So we want you to rate it. Your three options are, number one, it's going well. Number two, it could be better. Number three, it's the worst. So you can take the poll on our Twitter page at BFM Radio. Alternatively, you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899.
Yeah, so you know, the COVID-19 pandemic has caused the largest mass disruption of education in modern history. I mean, that's up to 1.6 billion children who have been affected by school closures at the height of the pandemic, when many countries were going under nationwide lockdowns. And according to that report that you mentioned, Juliet, that's jointly released last week by UNICEF and the International Telecommunication Union, 2.2 billion youths do not have internet access at home. And this includes 1.3 billion children and almost 760 million youths.
Yes, and if you look at the world before the pandemic, children and youths were already increasingly connected online. So, according to a UNICEF report from 2017, youths aged between 15 to 24 are the most connected age group, while children and adolescents under 18 accounted for about 1 in 3 internet users around the world.
Yes. However, despite them being online more, their lack of internet access is a global issue. So the recent UNICEF report used the latest available household survey data, and it found significant inequities between countries, regions, wealth groups, and urban-rural settings. So while the global average of children and young people with internet access at home was about 33%, high-income countries had 87% coverage compared to 6% in low-income countries. And, you know, that's a really large difference.
Mm. And other studies have also highlighted different aspects to the digital divide. So, for example, it's not simply about access to the internet, but how children are able to utilize it as well. So the UNICEF report in 2017 stated that children or youths who have to rely on smartphones instead of computers would not have the best online experience. Safe to say that many websites and apps have been developed for the smaller screens, it's not always the most conducive when you're using it for work, let alone to study. And on top of that, children who lack digital skills may also find the online world difficult to navigate, let alone find education-related content.
And as with many of the issues that we bring up, you know, there's always the gender gap as well. So smaller studies by UNICEF, which looked at specific regions, also provided some insights into this. So one that looked at countries in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, found that girls were disadvantaged in acquiring ICT skills, whether they were learning at home or if they were learning in school. And that means that, you know, they will find it more difficult to navigate these online learning platforms. And that in turn, you know, in the future, that could impact their ability to access online services as an adult. And then there was another UNICEF study that looked at countries in East Asia and the Pacific. And they also found that many students live in limited areas with limited internet coverage. So families may not be able to afford internet at home. They may not have any digital devices, or even if they have some, you know, they don't have enough for every child. And in those circumstances, they found that in some cases, parents may tend to favor the boys over the girls.
Mm. Right. And that leads on to the next issue of disrupted education, which is a global issue that has been further exacerbated by the pandemic. So data from UNESCO Institute for Statistics in 2018 showed that 1 in 5 children worldwide are out of school. And it's a number that has barely changed over the period of 5 years before that. But even with the children in schools, they were not necessarily learning. 617 million children and adolescents worldwide were failing to reach minimum proficiency levels in reading and maths.
Yeah, so now with the pandemic forcing educators and students to move online, you know, this digital divide is likely to further worsen that education gap that already exists. Looking at Malaysia, school-going children were barely in school for more than half a year this year. And, you know, school was suspended for months during the initial MCO. They began reopening in July, only to close again for the rest of the year in November. You know, we heard many teachers trying to keep up with their students, you know, whether it was online classes, messaging platforms. But, of course, not every student across Malaysia has access to digital devices or internet.
Yeah, and there have been so many stories about educators and students trying to teach and learn despite that gap. There was the teacher in Cebu, for example, as well as another in Kemaman, who made house calls with their students to check on them and make sure they're keeping up with their students as best they can. But there's been so many reports of students having to struggle to connect to the internet.
I think almost everyone would know of Viviana Musibin's story, you know, living in a remote part of Sabah. The university student had filmed herself having to climb a tree to get a good internet connection for her to take her test. And another instance reported recently was in Kelantan. So a father had to set up a tent on a hill to get a good internet connection for his daughter because of the poor coverage in their village and other nearby ones. And, you know, there's also the very heartbreaking story of 8 students in Ranau, Sabah, who were really badly injured because they were trying to gain internet access for their online class. So a wooden bridge in the village was one of the few places that they could get intermittent cellular signal. Unfortunately, the bridge gave way when 8 students had gathered at the spot, and the students suffered pretty bad injuries when they fell. So these are just a few of the instances highlighting the extent to which students in Malaysia have to go to in order to get basic internet, you know, something that all of us here in the studio, for example, just take completely for granted. And mind you, Malaysia is an upper middle income country.
Yeah, so I mean, these are anecdotal stories that we've read in the news. So to find out more, if we have that hard data on what it's like, or what a digital divide might look like in Malaysia, you know, the impact that it could have on our education, on the education of Malaysian children, we are joined via Zoom today by Azlina Kamal, an education specialist from UNICEF Malaysia. So thanks for joining the show, Azlina. To start, you know, do we have any data or statistics on what the level of internet access is like for children in Malaysia, and what are the disparities that exist for internet access?
The data that we have is based on the Ministry of Education. They did conduct a research involving 700,000 parents and 900,000 students on student gadget ownership. So we that data was shared in a presentation, and the findings from that. So it's not it's quite a huge number, although it's not exhaustive as we know, but it gives us an idea on the issue. And from the findings of that research, we know that children who have PC, urban and rural, so the ones that have PC at home, 6.3% urban and 2.8% rural. The ones with tablet in the urban areas, about 5.9% and 3.2% in the rural area. And mobile phone, interestingly, 48.2% in the urban areas and 34.4% in the rural areas. However, the ones without gadgets, you'll be surprised to know, 36.2% without gadgets are in the urban areas and 35.3% are in the rural areas. So the difference in terms of urban and rural when it comes to gadget ownership and lack of gadget ownership is minimal between the urban and rural areas. Of course, you know, a bit more disaggregated data on this will be helpful to know in terms of gender disaggregation and knowing further, what kind of household and things like that would be more helpful. But these are the numbers that we have now. And in terms of internet speed, I think medium speed for about 40.3% in the urban and 31% in the rural areas. So So yeah, I think you've highlighted that critical point, right? I think, you know, we know that 1.6 billion children globally have been out of school at the height of the crisis. We know that governments and education stakeholders have all responded swiftly to try and mitigate the learning loss so that we can have children's learning continue. You know, looking at various delivery channels, digital tools, TV, radio-based teaching, and take-home packages, as you've highlighted earlier. But yes, the closure, the lack of access will lead to huge loss of learning, which can then lead to disengagement, especially among those who are already at risk of dropping out. And, you know, short interruptions in children's schooling can have very long-lasting negative impacts on their learning.
It's interesting that you mentioned there's a minimal difference between urban and rural differences, because often there's a larger gap in studies that look at the digital divide. Do we know why the gap is minimal in that study?
We don't really know, actually, in terms of... I was quite surprised with the findings as well. But, you know... This is also congruent with, you know, some of the reports that we're finding in terms of school children in low and low middle income countries, though. But, you know, they were less likely to have access to remote learning and to be monitored on a day-to-day basis by teachers. But then again, there is also this fallacy that because children are in urban areas, they would readily have access to things. People always think that, oh, you know, just because a child, this is partially true, but I think increasingly in an upper middle income country like Malaysia, we're also looking at inequities and lack of access among the urban poor. And I think that is an issue that, you know, we need to also recognize.
And the pandemic and the MCO in its various forms has underscored the importance of internet access for children, especially if education has to move online to a certain degree. So what have been the implications of the lack of internet access on children's education?
You know, as I mentioned earlier, right, governments everywhere have responded rather swiftly in terms of looking at remote learning, alternative learning. But I think you're right. It's important for us to understand who has had access to remote learning interventions, how were they used, and the extent of their effectiveness. And what we know for sure is that the massive scale of school closures caused by COVID has laid bare the uneven distribution of technology needed to facilitate this remote learning. It has also highlighted the lack of preparedness and low resilience of systems. And this is based on, you know, global research as well, to support teachers, facilitators, parents, caregivers in the successful and safe use of technology for learning. So I think what it has required all of us to do is to look at the nature of learning and the terms and role of engagement. In terms of, you know, what it means, not just in terms of access to learning, that is a critical issue, of course. And then there is also the issue of quality. So just because, so on one hand, we have children not being able to access learning online, despite the fact that, and I must highlight this, that in Malaysia, at least there is an online learning platform already ready since last year for children and teachers to have access to online learning. And 5 million children you know, have access to this online learning. However, again, the question is, given the issues of connectivity, lack of gadget ownership, and various other socioeconomic factors as a result of COVID, I think the issue of access, as well as when children have access online, what are they learning? How do we keep them safe? Looking at, in terms of, you know, what kind of curriculum online, how do we motivate learners? I think all that come into play as well. So I think there's issue of access and equity and inclusion, but also in terms of quality.
And on that note of quality, if students are learning but, you know, at a lower quality than they and than what they normally would do, is that better than not learning anything at all, you know, if the quality of education is not there?
I don't think it's, you know, either or situation. I think, you know, the work that we do in terms of supporting the government and working with all our other partners is to look at both. So what we do is that where there is already a system available, we look at how do we maximize the potential of that system, right? So in terms of enhancing its quality, in terms of, you know, mainstreaming this, innovating it, working with partners, various ways in which we leapfrog on, say, innovation and creativity. Then also then the other question of, okay, who is being excluded from this and why are they excluded? And how do we then advocate and make sure that we bring those who are in the fringes, groups which are marginalized, into the mainstream so that they also then have access to that, to that quality. I don't see it as an either or. It is a two-pronged approach. So one is on strengthening systems, increasing quality, and the other is at the same time making sure that those who are not having access, those who are marginalized, have access. So I give you an example on this, right? Say we know that some children are children in the bottom 40, children with disabilities, Indigenous children. So what we've also done is to work with the ministry and other partners to see who are these children and where are they, right? So, you know, when we look at data, sometimes we forget that, you know, we look at averages and what's happening on the surface. But then when you look at disaggregated data, and that's what we're trying to do, who are these children specifically, right? This child. So if you look at while COVID is happening, who is this child now at the center of it all, who is poor, comes from a, you know, low socioeconomic status home, is in the bottom 40, is probably has disabilities, has to now, is not able to go to school either because they don't have gadgets to access learning online, or if, you know, they're the group of children that can go back to school previously, they live far from school, they now have household chores and duties in terms of, you know, running the home. Probably their parents have lost jobs. They now have to help with the, you know, getting some kind of income for their parents. So and there are many factors, right? So what we need to do then also is to look at this multiple deprivation lens. And then we know who is this child, where is this child, and how do we look at targeted interventions in terms of using data and evidence to kind of reach this child. So now these data and information, they're there. So what we need to do is to kind of look at this, and that's what we've been doing. And we've got some progress as to, okay, now we know who are these children, how many are they, and then how do we then leverage in partnerships and work with different stakeholders to kind of make sure that we have the targeted responses needed for this group of children so that they don't get further marginalized.
So to bring in UNICEF Malaysia's recent issue of Families on the Edge report, you know, it was found that nearly one in five families reported that their children are losing interest in school. Do we know what are the reasons behind that waning interest, and is it linked to online learning?
That's partially it. I think what we underestimate is that, you know, learning is a social process, right? And for children to be removed from this entire social process of learning in the school. So they don't just go to school to learn. They have friendships and networks. They learn other things, communication, a lot of other skills that children acquire besides, you know, academic skills. So this holistic development of this child that happens in the school, and now they are removed from all these interactions, that definitely has an impact. And, you know, people always think, oh, we're just moving everything from what we did face to face. We now just move everything online. You know, there's some adaptations required. We're not just, you know, changing one medium to another and transplanting of this. So that is something in that change. Children have to grapple, young people have to grapple with that change. And we know change is not an easy process for anyone, let alone a child or a young person. And they've also, as a result, been, learning at home, isolated from their friends. There is fatigue in terms of, not being able or going through this MCO, being detached from everything and everyone. There are then issues in terms of mental health, socio-emotional well-being, maintaining some kind of motivation to keep going, being isolated, not having that social network and friendships. And the other thing, as we've talked about earlier, is the access to proper equipment to learn, and then having to grapple with all the other impact to the family as a result of COVID as well. So there is a collective loss of normalcy, and I think we underestimate the grieving that needs to happen as a result of that loss of normalcy as well.
So do you think the pandemic is changing how we view education? You know, with schools having to go online now, can we return to the traditional form of learning, or is there a need to incorporate more online lessons in the future and, bridge that digital divide?
Yeah, I think that's a good point in terms of that closing of the digital divide. I think we've talked about, the need to close the digital divide, I think, for more than 20 years. But I think now it gives an urgency for us to look at how do we do this, right? So while I talked earlier about how it's magnified a lot of problems, it's also given us an opportunity to accelerate all the things that we need to do in terms of, building back better and stronger and more inclusively. And so going back, you're right, is not an option. It cannot be an option because if we keep doing more of the same, we are not going to progress. Right? So this is an opportunity for us to forge ahead with partnerships, with innovation, with creativity to say, how do we look at using the most effective crisis recovery strategies for long-term improvements in terms of areas like assessment, pedagogy, technology, financing of education and parental involvement, right? So, and instead, how do we then look at education systems in terms of aiming to recover, not replicating the past, given that our pre-COVID status quo was already characterized by too little learning, high levels of inequality and inequities, and also slow progress, right? So if we act quickly and strategically, then we can look at opportunities to build education systems which are much better and more prepared to deal with future shocks in education. So this is not going to be the last of such shocks in education. And there was a World Bank report that also talked about this. But some of the other lessons that we've learned and I've alluded to earlier as well, how do we look at connectivity, software, devices, teacher training, building teacher capacity. And this was one of the things that we also worked on 4 weeks into the pandemic. We did a quick survey on Telegram with teachers. We got over 1,300 teachers. 86% said that they needed help to be, online educators. And for a lot of them, they felt that, they need to know how to organize classrooms online, how to engage with students. And so UNICEF with the Ministry of Education, NARUS Education, we came up with this Community Guru Digital Learning, which is which looks at building teacher capacity so that they become more effective remote learning educators. And this was recognized as, one of the promising practices of equitable learning in 127 countries, because what we do is that we go through all the different modules looking at engaging learners. We also look at accessibility features for children and teachers with disabilities. And so far, we've got over 3,000 teachers from nearly 2,000 schools who've engaged and built their capacity online. And we're looking now at a repository where teachers who've undergone that training program are now developing materials and sharing it online. We've got over 1,000 resources. Now we're looking at expanding that to see how we also build teacher capacity, recognizing that this is an important area. Another lesson that, you know, in terms of not looking back, in terms of the social phenomenon of learning, as I mentioned earlier, the school is a social space as well for learning and experience. And it's also a place where children learn essential life skills, right? And so how do we then look at when we move learning online? How do we maintain all this, 21st century skills, critical literacy skills, especially when it comes to digital literacy skills, keeping in mind, you know, the various dangers and fake news and things like that that we have as well online. What we've also learned is the immense role of the teacher, right? So interaction between students and teachers in learning, and therefore greater investments in terms of training, software, the right level of differentiation for different groups of children, for a more tailored and personalized learning experience becomes very important. And another equation in this whole experience of COVID we've learned is the critical role of parents in the education experience of children, right? So how do we look at policies that are geared towards supporting parents to facilitate children's learning, especially in the early years and also at the lower primary level? So there are concerns that, you know, children who are supposed to have started school, right, their first year of schooling, and not being able to do that is also concerning, especially in the early years.
You also brought up digital literacy for children, and children going online also exposes them to possible exploitation. So how do we balance ensuring that children have access to the internet to learn and explore while also protecting them from potential predators?
I think the concern, the protection concern of children being online was already there, earlier on, even prior to COVID, right? But now increasingly, you know, looking at, so from an education point of view, how do we help children understand, critical literacy skills, and how do we develop that in our lessons? And one of the areas that we work with is the realignment of the curriculum to global citizenship education frameworks, as well as education for sustainable development frameworks, which we're also working on with the ministry and RS Education on this. So there are different things that we're looking at. So we're looking at, for UNICEF specifically with the government, they're one of our key partners in terms of leveraging on, you know, systemic change. We're looking at issues like connectivity, devices, teacher training, and also in terms of that whole teaching learning process and online engagement. So yeah.
And just tying it back to where we started, which was, you know, how access to the internet impacts education. What do we need to prioritize to improve access to the internet as well as education for our children?
I think there was a report recently released of UNESCO, UNICEF and World Bank, right? So what they did was to look at responses, national systems and how they've responded to COVID, and what are the emerging key areas that require further exploration. One is to monitor student dropout and disengagement. I think this is coming up very clearly. Because there is a real concern that children who were probably at medium risk of dropping out are now even, you know, the risk of their dropping out is further enhanced, right? So I think looking at disengagement and student dropout becomes even more important. And we talked that the other area is on the continued role of distance learning, remote learning, diversifying different ways in which distance and remote learning can happen besides the use of gadget, right? Like say, for example, the Community Guru Digital Learning Initiative that I was talking about earlier, we're also looking at how teachers can engage learners on Telegram, for example, on WhatsApp groups. We even, for one of our programs on Future Skills for All, we actually created an account on TikTok Guru Future Skills, which has provided to be really powerful with young people, right? So I think looking at different ways in which we engage with young people for their learning becomes very important. And also then, you know, looking at, you know, tracking the effectiveness of the different forms of online distance remote learning. And also I think another thing that has come through is in terms of the new approaches and shifting role of learning assessments. As we know, a lot of the national or the year-end examinations that move to more of school-based assessments. So I think building teacher capacity for this, looking at different ways of online and learning assessments online becomes even more important. I think another opportunity is to also look at localizing decisions with regard to reopening of schools. We know that, you know, sometimes it's easier to kind of have this centralized decision making on, you know, which school remains closed or open and things like that. But I think that also increasingly there's an opportunity for these decisions to be made at the at a more localized level in terms of school reopening, because the as we know also with COVID and the numbers and the cases, it is not the same everywhere, right? So where children can have access to schools, we should encourage that, because we know of the potential benefits of that social environment of learning.
So before we let you go, Azlina, do you have a final message for our listeners?
You know, I just wanted to share, there's this lovely tagline, if not mistaken, by UNICEF in Indonesia that says, "Kerana kita semua ibu bapanya," right? We are all parents or parental figures to every child. And so, you know, while we've talked a lot about the challenges and some of the, you know, disturbing perspective and challenges of the pandemic, I think it also gives us a unique opportunity to come together for all children, because we are all affected in one way or another, though in different degrees, to different degrees, right? So while the COVID is unprecedented, the crisis is unprecedented, it's also an opportunity for unprecedented solidarity for children and also for humanity. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Azlina. That was Azlina Kamal, an education specialist from UNICEF Malaysia. And she was talking to us about, you know, the issues with internet access for children here in Malaysia, how the move to online learning is impacting both teachers and students alike, and really, you know, the priorities that we need to look at for our education system in the future.
That's right. And, you know, I mean, I guess even for us with good internet access, it's been so difficult, you know, just to do anything, right? Mm. I mean, we've all realized it. Like, can you imagine what people in rural areas, I mean, we're reading all the reports, it's really, we're not going to see the impact. We're going to see those impacts in a while, and it's going to be pretty bad.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today's show. But you can look us up on Facebook if you'd like to drop us a message. Just search for BFM The Bigger Picture and you can find us there. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio, and you can also send us a WhatsApp message at 018-789-8899. Coming up at 3 p.m., it's Earth Matters, and I'll be sticking around to speak to Kennedy Michael, who is the founder of the Friends of Sungai Klang Taman Melawati River 3 program. And joining him is co-founder Xuan Teo, and they're going to be talking about how they've, you know, gotten together the whole community to rescue, rehabilitate and revive a once kind of very dirty river over in Taman Melawati, which is now really a thriving one. So again, if you miss any part of the show, you can download the podcast at bfm.my/dailydigest. You can find us on the BFM app. We're also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. This has been The Daily Digest on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.